Today, we're very pleased to welcome students from the Wakefield School in the Plains, Fauquier County, and also from Fork Union Military Academy. So if you see them as you go through the building, please extend a welcome to them. We're delighted that they are here with us. But welcome today to the Miller Center Forum. Several weeks ago, Mark Bowden, who is the author of the book Guests of the Ayatollah, The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam, told us, quote, "All things in the Middle East eventually brush shoulders with Iran, and we have to deal with Iran and understand Iran." During this past year, we've presented 12 programs that have dealt at least in part with Iran, our traditional ally, which actually has a land area that's one-third the size of the United States. It's bounded largely by hostile and unreliable neighbors, but it's an important presence in the Middle East. We opened our forum season with former National Security Council official and University of Virginia professor William Quant, painting for us a picture of the very complex web of relationships that bind the countries and peoples of the Middle East. Later during the season, we had Colonel Patrick Lang, who highlighted the ligaments that tie Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. Then a young reformer, Ruspa Mirabrahimi, aided by our friend and university professor R.K. Ramazani, who is with us today in the back, told us about the difficult challenges faced by the reform movements in Iran. So it's fitting that as our season draws to a close, we hear a deep assessment of the current politics of Iran. What does Iran and its president, Ahmadinejad, really want? We welcome today Dr. Fred Mokhtari, a native of Iran who attended schools in Tehran, came to the United States as a student, earned his undergraduate degree at the College of Worcester in Ohio, and his doctorate at the University of Delaware. He returned to his native land to work in 1973 and then left in 1979 at the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. He taught for many years at Norwich University in Vermont, and then 5 years ago joined the faculty of the National Defense University in Washington. Dr. Mokhtari is at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. It's a particular personal pleasure to welcome Dr. Mokhtari because he and I share the four most beautiful grandchildren in the world, except for maybe some of your grandchildren. His son, Cyrus, is married to my daughter, Carter, and we've become good friends over the years. Please welcome Fred Mokhtari.
Thank you very much. Well, after that introduction, let me just add that not only it's a pleasure to be here, but it's also good because George has been a speaker at our center several times, and it's nice to be able to reciprocate. But it really is a pleasure to be here. Before I start, I'd like to make two clarifications. Number one, what I'm about to say is an explanation, at least an attempt to explain the policies of the current regime in Iran. It's not to defend it. So that's very important. The second one is that what I'm saying and what I'm about to say is my opinion, has nothing to do and does not reflect the official position of the Near East South Asia Center, nor the National Defense University, nor the Department of Defense, nor the US government. So let's put my cards on the table. I'm going to point out, or at least attempt to point out, a few issues that are often central to misunderstanding between Iran and the United States. After that, I'll open this to questions, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. I'm sure you have more questions that I could sort of anticipate. But those points that often cause misunderstanding or misperception are the following. Number one, we mix up Iranians, the nation, with the clerics that are in power. We don't make a distinction between those groups or the group that are in power now versus the nation. And a distinction really is very important. So what the people who are in power in Tehran do and say is not necessarily a reflection of the national sentiment. We often forget that. And if I may say so, the commentators and the media are to some extent guilty of this. Many of the commentators, it seems to me, write things for each other rather than trying to enlighten the public. So they confirm each other's biases in many respects. The second point I like to raise is that Iran is still in a revolutionary period. The revolution has not run its course. And therefore, the sentiments that are expressed by the revolutionaries are not necessarily representative of the national interest. The historians amongst us, and I know at least one who's sitting here, know that this happens in every revolution. The cause of the revolution, the ideals of the revolution during the early stages supersede the national interest. As time goes on, the national interest will reimpose and reassert itself. The revolution in Iran has not run its course, and therefore, at times, you hear things that are still pursue the cause, the revolutionary cause, and they are, in fact, contrary to the national interest. We don't make that distinction, and we ought to. And in fact, if you look at the history of the revolution in the past 20-some years, you see that the emphasis on the revolution has been declining, whereas the national interest has been reasserting itself. In many respects, the policies of the government today in foreign policy and so on resemble the policies of the previous regime that these guys wanted to discard. The third point, and this is very much in vogue today, is Ahmadinejad's power and popularity. And a lot of clarification really is needed there. First, about his popularity. There is a myth that he has a mandate, he was elected by an overwhelming majority, and so on and so forth. A closer look will tell you a different story. Mr. Ahmadinejad, I won't get into details of this, but when he ran for presidency, during the first round, he received 19% of the vote cast by 12% of the eligible voters. His opponent, the major opponent, whose name was Rafsanjani, a previous president, received 21% of the vote cast by 13% of the eligible voters. They went to the second round. At the second round, there was Mr. Rafsanjani, a cleric wearing the turban, representing the establishment, the clerics, and so on, versus a fellow who did not wear a turban. In Iran, they make a distinction. They call him Kolahi versus the turban person versus the hat-wearing person. So there was this hat-wearing person versus the turban-wearing person. So there was this rejection of the clerics versus this fellow who did not represent the clerics. The cleric was very rich, the richest person in the country, versus this guy who really had nothing to his name. During the second round, Ahmadinejad received 62% of the vote cast by 37% of the voters, and the other guy received 36% of the vote cast by 21% of eligible voters. So if you combine those, during the first round, the total number of people who voted, or the eligible voters, the percentage of eligible voters during the first round combined for both was 25%. The second round was 58%. Now, this is not really reflective of a landslide of support for a person, but that's just leave that for a moment. There was a mayoral election about a week and a half, two weeks ago in Tehran. The person who ran for that office was a gentleman called, not really gentle, but he's a fellow called Ghalibaf. Ghalibaf has been an opponent of Ahmadinejad, and Ahmadinejad did everything he could to prevent that guy from getting reelected. Well, he did get reelected. In December, late December, there was an election for the Guardian Council. This is a very influential committee. These are the people who elect the supreme leader and so on. Ahmadinejad supported seven candidates and campaigned very hard for them. Not a single one of those won. So my point is, if you put these things together, these fragments, you see a picture that is quite different from what is constantly imagined, that this guy is very popular and represents the popular sentiment. Now, as far as his power, he has the title of president, but as you know, the decisions are not made by him. There's a supreme leader, which is, again, one of those ironic things. We had a king who never dreamed of doing the things that the supreme leader does. The revolution got rid of the king and replaced it with a guy who wears a turban, but in fact commands much more power than the king ever did. So there might be a crown under that turban after all. Well, the decisions are made by somebody else, and therefore, as the president, he really does not have the powers that we commonly associate with the office of the president. Furthermore, about a year ago, 173 parliamentarians called to impeach this guy because they thought he was an embarrassment. He was a national embarrassment. The supreme leader apparently called them to his office and said, "You better not pursue this because this would, in fact, destabilize the regime. And therefore, you better just cool it." Following that, five of his cabinet members, his own cabinet, including Mr. Larijani, who, again, is a challenger to him, and he's the head of the nuclear negotiations. They went to the supreme leader and told him that they can't deal with this guy. They cannot work with this guy. And again, the supreme leader told them to, we cannot remove this guy. We have to let him serve his time, because doing anything of that sort, again, will not be good for the regime. So again, the point here really is that this guy neither commands the popularity that we imagine he does, nor the power that the office of president suggests and we associate with him. The next point I like to raise is that decision making by the regime is a puzzle for us, in fact, for almost anyone who tries to figure out how decisions are made in Tehran. The reality is that the nature of the regime resembles a tribal system. There are about 30 different groups, very influential, and there is a cleric at the head of each one of them. They make decisions collectively. So these 30 people representing 30 tribes, 30 major interest groups, They are not political parties, but they are really major interest groups. And one cleric at the top of each. And they are very jealous of each other, constantly vying for power and asserting their own power and so on. On essential issues, there has to be a collective decision. Despite all the competition and so on, they know that if they fragment, the system will fall apart, and if the system falls apart, their own lives are on the line. They remember quite well what they did to the previous regime, and therefore they know what is likely to happen to them if they lose power. Therefore, they try to make decisions collectively. Now, this is very difficult to understand because every one of these tribes with the cleric at the top, in fact, behaves as if he represents the government in its totality. So they make statements as if they represent the government, and in fact, they don't. The decisions have to be made collectively, especially on important issues. So again, that is one of those things that that is hard to understand, and but in fact, that's how things are. Now, what does the nation really want? The Iranians, as a people, as a nation, want first and foremost respect. They think they have not received the respect that is due them. Because of their history, because of their size, because of their geography, because of the contributions they have made, cultural, political, et cetera, et cetera. And they have a feeling that they have never been taken seriously. Even when they were allies of the United States, they were not taken seriously or given enough respect. I can give you a few anecdotal examples of this, but I would refer you, for instance, to a statement by famous historian Dr. Roy Mottahedeh, who has taught at Harvard and now Princeton. He has a book called On the Mantle of the Prophet, or Mantle of the Prophet. And there's a statement in it. He says the Iranian people, generally, before the revolution, thought that their king, who was an ally, remember, from 1943 or so until 1978, the Shah, the king, and the government, and Iran as a whole, was an ally of the United States and went to great length to do things in pursuit of U.S. interest. One of which, by the way, was fighting a 16-year-long insurgency in the Persian Gulf. The Kingdom of Oman, the Sultanate of Oman and United Arab Emirates would not exist today, at least the way we know them, had it not been for Iran spending quite a big chunk of treasure and in fact, blood and treasure to put down that insurgency, which took about 16 years. Americans did not fight that war. The British did not fight that war. The Arab armies did not fight that war. It was the Iranian Navy that fought that, and part of the army helicopter wing that fought that war. So, but Roy Mottahedeh in a passage says that Iranians thought that the Shah was always treated not as an ally, but as a petitioner to the court of the West. And this was really very, very discomforting and degrading for the Iranians. And there are other anecdotal examples that I could tell you. So Iranians want respect, and they want to have autonomy in pursuit of their national interest. They don't want to be told what to do because it's in the interest of somebody else. They want to have that autonomy. We accept that when it comes to many other countries. India is a prime example. But somehow it seems we have trouble accepting that when it comes from Iran. Added to that is Iran's feeling of humiliation. And that is something very similar to the way that the Chinese felt for many years. And there's this desire to reassert their position in the sun, so to speak. So that's what the Iranians want. What does the regime want? That is very simple. The regime wants to survive. That is the primary thing they want, survival. Now, you get a sort of feeling for what I'm saying. There is the Iranian narrative is quite different from the narrative that is heard here. There is a narrative that reflects grievances, the feeling of letdown, betrayal, et cetera, et cetera. And we often forget that. Basically, we would like to forget the past and constantly think about the present and perhaps about the future, but the past is past and, you know, get on with it, forget about it. Well, the Iranians can't forget the past. That's a part of their culture, especially if you have, you know, several thousand years of culture, and part of it has been very great. You really can't forget that identity and move on. So that baggage is always there, and they make references to that, and based on those references, they try to figure out what is to come. This is especially true during the current debate regarding nuclear policy. I talk about that in just a moment. We often mix up Iran's nuclear policy with its defense policy. The two are different. They are related, of course, but they are two different issues. Iran's defense policy is basically a military and security issue. Iran finds itself, and Iranians see themselves, in an area that is not very friendly. You have something I wrote a couple of years ago. I think there is a reference there to Iranians see their neighbors sitting on territories that at one point belonged to them. Well, psychologically, they really have a siege mentality. You know, all the people sitting around them have been rather, well, to say the least, not very nice to them. And therefore, if this trend continues, what is going to be left? The current geographical territory of Iran, although it is one-third the size of the United States, is less than half of what it was only 200 years ago. So the idea that Iranians have territorial ambition really falls flat if you see what the neighbors have done to Iran, and then add to that the reality that Iran has not attacked a neighbor for the past 100 years, yet the neighbors have attacked it repeatedly. Now, if you're sitting in Iran, now we're talking about the nation, if you're sitting in Iran and you see the discussions about bombing the country, about doing nasty things to it, especially after the experience with Iraq not too many years ago, you really begin to understand the siege mentality and how they so quickly stiffen their backs when they are attacked, even verbally. So then the national defense issue, which is really very important, and it is real. Their defense concerns are real and compelling. They look around them and they see the Arab neighbors are not very friendly. And in fact, repeatedly, they have tried to do nasty things to them. And of course, the talk of renaming the Persian Gulf as the Arabian Gulf, calling the province of Khuzestan in the south Arabistan, and things of that sort, that really gets on their nerves. And they see and read more to it than really exists. You know, they see all of these as indications of threatening the territory and national integrity. So again, all around you see you have the Arab countries who all, by the way, helped and financed Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. They see the United States with bases all around the country, completely surrounding the country. They see Pakistan as being potentially in a state of possible turmoil. And of course, there are border issues, not with the government of Pakistan, but these insurgency in Balochistan, and those things could spill over the border and create problems for Iran. Afghanistan is not out of the woods. There is some trouble in Central Asia. The Caucasus, there is some problems there, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and so on. Turkey is having difficulties with the Kurds, and that could spill over into Iran. The last thing Iran wants, by the way, is to have a confrontation with Turkey over the Kurds. And of course, Iraq is in turmoil. So they look around and they see their borders are in a state of threat and tension. So from the defense policy, they have to defend themselves, but they have a basic problem. And the problem is that during the Iran-Iraq war, they had this fancy military, most of it purchased from the United States, that could not do very much for them, because as soon as the war started, the United States imposed an embargo on spare parts and ammunition. Now, you must realize that what we do has, you know, what we do have consequences. Well, based on that experience, they know that relying on conventional weapons purchased from outside is not gonna help them. So they have to come up with a means of defending themselves that is homegrown, which is dependable. The fancy aircraft and tanks and so on that they had bought became useless within a week. So that is the major problem about their defense. Now, the nuclear policy really has more political impetus. It is more of a political issue than a defense issue. It is political because, first of all, they insist that they want to have this because it gives them prestige, it shows the nuclear, the scientific know-how and so on. And again, people will take them seriously as an equal partner during, you know, negotiations and so on the international scene. But at the same time, it plays another role, and that is it provides at least the potential for a deterrent. And deterrent what they really want. The pursuit of nuclear technology is not to become a nuclear threat to anyone, but rather to have a homegrown means of deterrence. Again, you must relate this to what I said earlier, being threatened from all sides. Now, there is a fine point here. Nuclear know-how, or in the parlance of strategists, nuclear capability is quite different from nuclear weapons and having nuclear weapons, testing nuclear weapons, or using nuclear weapons. Nuclear capability provides at least the impression that there is something here that you don't want to provoke. Nuclear weapons, on the other hand, makes the country a target, because having a few nuclear weapons is not going to make you safe against an adversary that has thousands. And therefore, for a country that wants deterrence, building a few nuclear weapons and threatening others is not a very smart thing to do. And unless we sort of imagine or work ourselves into imagining that all Iranians are a bunch of idiots, that idea should not be given tremendous credibility, although I'm not saying it should be discarded. Iranians, like all nations, have idiots among them. But the point is that, at least I hope, they are not the majority. So the nuclear issue really is a political issue more than a defense issue. And again, I'm sure there will be questions about this, and I'll be happy to clarify that further. The Iranians have made this issue an issue of national pride, and therefore, at this point, we really cannot turn the clock back. I actually warned that the policies that we had initiated several years ago could turn this issue into an issue of national pride, and it has. So that is unfortunate. But the Iranians do have, as far as enrichment is concerned, a legal case. We can debate this all we want, but the reality is that signing the NPT does not make you give up enrichment. In fact, there are numerous countries that are signatories to NPT and are not nuclear countries, nuclear nations, but they do have enrichment facilities. And I could name a few: Japan, Germany, the Netherlands, Brazil, Argentina, and so on. And we don't seem to be excited about that. The bottom line really is that we don't trust the regime in Iran. That is the core issue, not the legal basis for enrichment. Let me end by just one more anecdote about why Iranians have a hard time trusting the promises that come from the West. In 1975, there was a company in France, a French company, enrichment company, called Eurodif. Eurodif is a company that manufactures, enriches nuclear rods and so on. Eurodif was in financial trouble. Iran paid $1 billion in 75. It's equal to about $2 billion, probably five now, and bought 10% of the shares, and Eurodif survived. Well, you would expect if you own 10% of the shares of a company, you would receive some enriched uranium if you need it. Well, how much uranium do you think Eurodif has delivered to Iran to this date? Not a single gram. And therefore, when commentators say, they don't need enrichment, they can buy it in the market, we give it to them. You know, it becomes a little hard to accept. So I leave it at that, and thank you very much for listening.
To move to the back of the room, and those who have questions, and we encourage people who have questions to ask them, please come to the back corner of the room and meet me there. I would like to open up, if I may, Dr. Mokhtari, with sort of an observation on some of your writings. I understand the perceived need for deterrence. I understand that the imported weapon systems that we and others have provided to Iran over the years are considered vulnerable because of the possibility of interrupting the supply of spare parts. And certainly one thing the United States and other allied nations could do to rebuild bridges with Iran is to resupply necessary parts that they could use to build their own defenses. But the big issue, especially for the United States, right now seems to be the very provocative statements directed by Ahmadinejad towards our other long-term ally, Israel. How in the face of the provocative statements directed at Israel does the United States either justify aid to Iran, and how do we keep whatever we might provide to Iran from being used for offensive purposes?
Okay, the issue of Israel is really a rather complicated issue, but it is very important. So let me talk about that a little bit. During the Iran-Iraq War, when the United States and Britain, Western allies, refused to supply Iran with spare parts and ammunition and so on, which Iran needed desperately to counter the Iraqis, who were receiving not only supplies and money from all directions, but reconnaissance assistance from the United States. And every time the Iranians would move their troops, the Iraqis knew exactly where they were. At that time, Israel was the country that was helping Iran with spare parts and supplies for Iran to defend itself. The relationship between Iran and Israel really is a lot more complicated, and there is a lot more to it than what appears, especially in the press here. The relationship between the two countries really is very deep, and it goes back not only thousands of years, going back to the time of Cyrus the Great and so on and so forth, but Iran was one of the first countries to recognize Israel and establish diplomatic relations, although it was de facto, going back to 19, I don't exactly remember the year, but certainly by 1947, 48, there was diplomatic representation there. What you see today reflects two different things. Number one, every time there is an attempt to have closer relationship, the tone of the voices that try to deflect what is going on sort of raises. At the time, for instance, that, again, another anecdote, during the early days of the revolutionary regime, Mr. Yasser Arafat came to Iran and asked Mr. Khomeini to send aircraft, Iranian aircrafts, to Lebanon to be used against Israelis. Khomeini, of course, said no. He was smart enough to know that was a no-no. But at the same time, he declared the Day of Jerusalem, called the Quds Day, and it's a national celebration every year. Now, why he did that? At some point, he did not give the Palestinians the assistance they had asked and expected because they had helped the revolutionaries. But at the same time, he raised the level of propaganda that we have devoted a day to celebrate you and so on. So this sort of thing goes on, and it's quite common. We should not get too much read too much into this. But there is another side to this, and that is for as long as Iraq and the Soviet Union were in the area threatening the region, Iran and Israel saw themselves as natural allies. And in fact, they cooperated openly or sometimes not so openly, but they were always in contact with each other and in sync. With the fall of the Soviet Union and demise of Saddam's regime, the two are now, rather than being natural allies, although they are not enemies, rather than being natural allies, they are competitors for supremacy in the region. And therefore, some of the statements that are made by one side versus the other side reflects that, although they both pose these in ideological terms, rather than saying, I pursue supremacy in the region versus the other one saying I seek hegemony in the region. They sort of formulate this in ideological terms. But that is the explanation. I don't think the Iranians as a nation have any ill will towards Israel, certainly against Jews. The Jewish population in Iran today is one of the largest ones outside of Israel, the United States. So there is affinity and cultural affinity to a great deal. I was in Israel not too long ago, and I was delighted to see, for instance, a large center built by Iranian Jewish donations at the University of Tel Aviv, $20 million recently built, that promotes the teaching of Persian language. And they have the largest storage of Persian classical music there. So this sort of thing goes on quite often.
Thank you for your talk. And actually, you had answered the first one question I had very well. So I'd like to ask you a more speculative question going back into history, since you were in Iran up to the revolution. And I know the Cold War was raging, so there's lots of external forces going on and constraining other countries. Do you think there was anything the Carter administration could have done prior to that revolution to sort of ease the transition into a more representative government? Did they miss any opportunity?
The answer is yes. But before you read again too much into this, let me tell you something that happened just last week. We have seminars at the Near East South Asia Center where we bring in leaders from friendly countries, from North Africa, Middle East, and South Asia, for seminars that run for 3 weeks and so on. We have discussions with them. One of these fellows, and I won't say which country, because we have a non-attribution policy at the NISA Center, unlike here, he said, there was this feeling from the very beginning of the seminar that United States engages in conspiracies against these countries and so on. By the end of the 3 weeks, he said, okay, now you've convinced me that there is no conspiracy. You just make mistakes. But the second sentence of it was really even better. He said, okay, I understand you make mistakes. And it's not malice. But believe me, it is hard to believe that the United States, with all its resources, all its brain power, makes so many mistakes so frequently. You know? And there really is something to that. Yes, there were things that could have been done differently during the Carter administration and even before that. But I don't think they were done out of malice. They were just mistakes. I mean, I give you one example. And these have tremendous impact in Iran, you know, and in other countries. When President Carter became president, as it is customary, all heads of states sent telegrams congratulating, you know, the other person. And of course, the Shah did the same. Well, it took President Carter and his, you know, people who work in the White House, took him 23 days to reply to that telegram. Well, you know, the Iranian people, you remember what I said, that they saw the Shah as a petitioner at the court. Well, this guy was an ally, and it was not being treated well enough. Again, I don't think it was malice. I don't think it was a decision to put him down. It just happened, but it had an impact, and the Iranians saw to this something more than what it really was. So there were things like that happened. At one point, I think President Carter, this was during the revolution, he was asked by a reporter, well, do you think the government of Iran is going to survive, or the Shah is going to survive? And his reply was, well, I hope so. And again, that had a tremendous impact in Iran. That's okay, the decision has been made, you know, he's been dumped. So, yes.
Thank you for your talk. I don't know if you had the TV news on this morning or not, but a grandmother with dual citizenship, Iranian and U.S., is over in Iran right now visiting her mother. She has been seized and put in jail and charged with trying to overthrow the government. Can this be just a political ploy? I can't believe they really think this woman is there to do them damage.
Well, the person you're referring to actually is a friend. Dr. Hala Esfandiari and her husband, Shaul Bakhash, were my colleagues when I was in Iran. We were both, well, all three of us, were journalists working at the Kayhan Group of Newspapers. This is the largest publishing house in the Middle East. So I know them from those days. Hale in those days would write for a magazine that was published by the same company called Zane Ruz, Today's Woman. And Shaul was a political commentator for Kayhan International, which was a daily English language paper. So I know them from those days. Hale was the director, or is still, the director of the Middle East Center at Woodrow Wilson Center. And she has a program through which she invites speakers from the region to come and speak. They have seminars, conferences, etc. She went to visit her mother, and this was actually last December. They didn't let her leave, and then last week they finally called her for questioning, but they sent her to jail. And the accusation is that she has been fomenting a velvet glove revolution. Well, on the face of it, again, this doesn't make much sense. And from a personal viewpoint, this is a tragedy. Halle is a wonderful scholar, and this really should not happen to anyone. But again, if you put things in perspective, there were a number of Iranians who were claimed, were associated with the diplomatic mission of Iran in Iraq, were seized by U.S. forces, despite protests by the Iraqi government and the Kurds in Kurdistan. And we haven't heard about that, although the Iranians have been saying, you know, release them, release them. So that, you know, that has taken place. At the same time, United States has been asking for discussions with the Iranians off and on, and a round of discussion is supposed to take place in Iraq within the next few days. But the United States has been saying, the only thing we're going to talk about is Iraq, nothing else. I imagine that there is a possibility that at least some factions, some of those tribes that I mentioned, have tried to put the United States in a place to force it to talk about something other than Iraq, number one, this would be one, and number two, to create a basis for one side saying, well, why didn't you release our people? And the other side saying, well, what about you? And, you know, and finally one side would say, well, it will have a positive effect if you release those, and, you know, and that might be a bargaining chip. But I agree with you that it's a tragedy, and it is an awful thing to do, to, you know, grab innocent people. There was another person who was grabbed today, by the way, too, Mr. Taj Bakhsh, another scholar who was there in Iran.
Our next questioner is General Greg Govan, who represented the United States in conventional arms negotiations.
Question isn't about conventional arms. You can relax. What does Iran really want? Does it want to be a leader in Islam, or does it want modernization, or does it want both? You've sketched out a rather compelling view of Iranians humiliated, not getting sufficient respect. One could extend this even to the role of Islam, something that developed in a more primitive society and was imposed on them. They established a different kind of Islam, and yet the Islam today seems very anti-modern. Where do they come down?
Well, again, you got to make a distinction between the regime and the nation. And that is the key. If your question is directed at the regime, what does the regime want? The regime has tried Islam as an ideology, as some others have also, has tried to use Islam as an ideology in order to forge, if not hegemony, at least support among all Muslims to stand up against what they perceive to be the imposition of the West. And that, by the way, is a euphemism for the United States. So let's be clear about it. It was shocking to many Arabs, especially the Saudis, for instance, who considered themselves to be the champions of Islam because the holy places are there. It was shocking to them when Khomeini, a Shiite, whom they really think Shiites are, you know, second class or third class, they are not really Muslims. So this guy, Shiite, gets up and says, I represent Islam, you know, the Ummah, Islamic community, and so on. And the Saudis were taken aback. So, yes, the regime wants to sustain itself and protect itself by creating a base of support among the, you know, so-called, this is a term that I don't like to use, but it's commonly used, the man in the street in the Arab world or the Muslim world. So they talk about Islam, and they are the protectors of it and promoters of it and so on. The Iranians as a nation, however, believe it or not, don't care. Iranians among the Muslims have the lowest rate of going to mosque, even when you have the Islamic Republic in power. The statistics were, I think I read this about 6-7 months ago. A publication put out, I think, by the Washington Institute. So Iranians are not really that that thrilled about using religion as a banner to or as an ideology to expand and so on. Iranians, again, let me refer to a statement by a French diplomat, Mr. Frédéric Tellier, who wrote about a year ago that nationalism is Iran's foremost religion. That is the religion that endures. That is the religion comes to confrontation with Islam will win, and so on. So Iranians are a lot more interested in their nation and their national integrity and the promotion of their culture and so on, and gaining respect, and being treated as a major power in the region. And they have a right to it. I mean, look at the map. It's the largest area with the largest population and so on. They want to be seen as an important part of the region. Not necessarily to push people around. And that is not really in the Iranian culture. Iranians, to some extent, again, don't really have any desire to grab anybody's land or anything of the sort. You know, if you want to be a part of Iran, fine. If you don't, good riddance, you know. Again, if you look at the people who have decided to go their own way, Iranians do not try to take Iraq back, although Iraq was a part of Iran until, 1534, there was a war with Ottoman Empire. It was lost to Ottoman Empire. It was gained back in 1623 and lost again in 1638. Iranians never really talk about getting Iraq back. It might be interesting to know that there is a city about 20 miles south of Baghdad. It is called Tisfun. If you look at the map, you see it. Tisfun is the old imperial capital of Persia before the Arab invasion. You have never heard Iranians talk about taking their capital back. They really don't care. Does that answer your question?
Since we've already gone back to the Shah a bit, I'd like to revisit a couple of things there. I considered in the 70s Iran one of the great allies of the United States. The Shah was very pro-Western, country relatively secular. Remember the newspapers of America, New York Times, Washington Post, vilified the Shah. He was like Hitler, according to some. The New Yorker just tore him apart week after week. And then you had in the government Ramsey Clark, who considered himself a friend of Khomeini, went over. I don't know that he ever met with him. And then there was Andy Young, who thought Khomeini was a saint, used that word. So there was these viewpoints in the United States at that time. I felt that that revolution was one of the singular events of my lifetime and would lead to huge instability. I just wonder what your views are on those things, the media of America, and then also some of the players in the Carter administration.
Well, my personal reaction is that it was terribly unfortunate. That was a period that Iranians, especially the educated Iranians, had returned to the country in force, and they were trying to move the country forward. Despite the popular impression that people did not know what they were doing, they knew that they were taking a tremendous risk. But the alternative was either we take this risk and we might win and move the country forward. The idea was that if we succeed within 15 years, we'll be almost where Spain was and South Europeans were. But if we lose, we lose. However, if we don't do anything, we lose too. So, you know, the possibility was that if we take the risk, we might win. If we don't take the risk, we're going to lose anyway. And therefore, people made that attempt, and unfortunately, we lost. It was a tragedy. It was an awful thing that happened. The nation has suffered tremendously. And the nation, the people in Iran really are the victims, and we overlook that. But in regards to the fickleness of the public and the journalists and so on, that reinforces the Iranian view that you really can't trust even your friends, you know? So you have to have your own source of power, your own source of defense. You basically have to look after yourself. And the title of the article you have is No One Scratches My Back. I mean, that is part of a poem. No one scratches my back except the nail on my own fingers. So that's the mentality of Iranians. They have been let down repeatedly. Let me also point out that, for instance, during the First World War, Iran declared its neutrality and it was invaded by Germany, Britain, Turkey, Russia. During the Second World War, it declared its neutrality twice. The first year of the Second World War, and then again the day that the Germans attacked Russia. Yet it was invaded by the Allies this time, you know, the good guys. And this has been going on. And then we talk about Iranians not following international law. Now, if you're sitting in Tehran, you scratch your heads. You know, why is it that international law applies only, you know, and it is a one-sided thing? So those grievances are there and form the opinion and decisions that are made. So, you know, to refer to what George said here, to change this atmosphere, we have to try to make the Iranians unlearn what they have learned. You know, talking is not going to do it.
I wanted to ask on why Iran would kidnap the British sailors. If it wants to get the U.S. to talk about something else, then why would it threaten the United Kingdom? Is it just, does that fit in the whole national pride issue and the distrust of the West, or is there something more to it?
Well, there are two possible answers to that. One is, and the simpler one, is that probably one of those tribes, one of those 30 groups, initiated that, or it was done by one of those hot-headed local fellows. Remember, this was not done by the Navy. It was done by the Revolutionary Guards. The Navy, interestingly enough, is officered by officers who were educated at the at Norwich University, where I taught for 20 years. And if you talk to naval officers of the United States, they say these guys are very correct. The Revolutionary Guards, however, are the ones who need work. So there is a possibility that it was done by one of those groups or a bunch of Revolutionary Guard sailors who have their own little navy without the decision by the government. But after it was done, the government had to make it look as advantageous to them as possible. So that's one answer. The other one is that when the British controlled Iraq, they drew the line, the borderline for Iraq, on the shoreline of Iran's side of the river that divides the two. The Arabs call that Shatul Arab. The Iranians call it Arvand Rud. So the border was the Iranian shoreline. Well, the Iranians, of course, never accepted that. In 1975 or so, Iran managed to assert its claim, and therefore the dividing line became the Talweg line, which is the deepest point in the middle of the river. Saddam Hussein signed that, and then on the day that he invaded Iran after the revolution, he went on television and tore that up. Now, this might have some relationship to that, that the British might have, I don't know this for sure, might have been on the wrong side of that middle lane. Now, they could say that they were in Iraqi waters, because according to their way of looking at things, you know, the shoreline is the border. According to the Iranians, it's in the middle of the river, and it continues to the Gulf. And of course, again, if you follow the news, one of them said that we were in international waters, and the other side said, no, according to the GPS, you were not. So I really don't know what the story was there. But those are the two explanations I could give you.
The man who asked the last question said to me while we were standing in the back, gee, this has caused me to think about Iran in a whole new way. And that really is the purpose of the forum program, and we're very grateful to Dr. Mukhtari for causing all of us to think about Iran in a new way. Thank you.